It's The Takeaway. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, host of the podcast What Next TBD from Slate, and I'm in for Tenzina Vega this week. The level of polarization in our country's politics can feel intractable these days, and the murder of George Floyd brought that divide to the forefront of conversations about race. While Black Americans and advocates for racial equity have long been aware of the role systemic racism plays across our country, there are many individuals who would prefer not to have these conversations, especially if these conversations are happening in schools.
Teaching kids to hate their country and to hate each other is not worth one red cent of taxpayer money.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, and he's not alone. Across the U.S., more and more conservative lawmakers in states like Tennessee, Arkansas, and Idaho are advancing bills to ban the teaching of critical race theory. Though it's a decades-old concept, critical race theory has become the latest target of conservatives reluctant to discuss how our history of racism and inequity is still being felt today, including in our education system. We're going to talk about all of this and more with Matt Bachenfeld, a high school social studies teacher at Fishers High School in Fishers, Indiana. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Lizzie. Thanks for having me back.
And also with us is Gloria Ladson-Billings, professor emerita at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and former Kellner Family Chair in Urban Education. Professor Ladson-Billings, thanks for coming on.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So, Professor, I'm going to call you Gloria. Before we get deep into the conversation, can you explain what critical race theory is for people who aren't familiar with it?
Well, as you said in your introduction, it is decades old. We're talking about 30 years of legal research that is a constellation of theories designed to explain racial inequity. When you begin to see patterns of behavior, social scientists want to know, how do we explain it? It's not just random. So it is a set of theories that suggest that racism is essentially normal in our society. It's not aberrant. It's not isolated incidents. It's those things that are in some ways baked into the way we do our governance and living. And on almost every measure of social welfare, we can see it.
Why do you think conservatives and some others have seized on this kind of language right now?
Well, I do think it is a bit of a dog whistle. Clearly, it was sent out there by our former president. Before that, no one ever actually uttered critical race theory outside of the academy. And once Donald Trump said he wanted to, quote, ban it. Now think about that. A nation that talks about free speech and free inquiry wants to ban a way of thinking about something. But once he said it, it became a kind of rallying cry. And I think that it just, what we're seeing is, as you said in your intro, a continuing polarization. So it becomes one more thing around which to rally.
Matt, tell me about the type of community you teach in and what you teach your students about race.
Well, I teach in what I guess I would call a purpling city on the edges of Indianapolis. And so it's historically quite conservative and the county is still quite conservative. But the city of Fishers itself is kind of undergoing this demographic shift that is sort of changing a whole lot about the city. And so sort of to answer that shift, we've been trying to make sure that we are having honest conversations about race. And so in my classroom, what I try and push back against is what I call the spaceship theory of racism. So to like describe what that means to us, a lot of folks treat racism like if you just rounded up all of the really overt racists in the country and you put them in a spaceship and you blasted them off to space, that you would fix the issue. And so the problem is stemming from like this 1% that are overtly racist and throwing slurs around. What we're trying to do is, I think what James Baldwin asked us to, he said the problem is deeper than we think because the problem isn't us. So racism is not best expressed through overt racists at all. I actually would argue that it's best expressed by looking at housing, employment, education, people's experiences with criminal justice and policing. And so when we talk about race in my class, we teach that our kids are learning on the edge of what was a sea of sundown towns. Sundown towns are towns that Black Americans were not allowed to be in after dark. Mm-hmm. And those are surrounding us in Indiana just because they have sort of their formally illegal does not mean that you don't see the remnants of it all around us. We teach about segregation in education. Right now, as we speak, our public education system is as segregated as it was in 1980. The nation's and really the world's eyes were on Minneapolis. I would point to Minneapolis's public schools as a better way to understand racism. That city is 65% white, but only 35% of their public school students are white. Why won't white parents send their kids to public schools in Minneapolis? That's true sort of everywhere you look. It's true here in Indianapolis.
True here in New York where I sit. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. We look at redlining. We actually took students through like a Google Maps tour to chart the redlining through Indianapolis. And we talk about what Eddie Glaude calls the value gap. The value gap is, I guess, the best way I could describe it very, very briefly. I'm 27 years old. And if you look at white 27-year-olds in America, according to Pew, about 6% of them grew up in impoverished neighborhoods. So that's not a typical experience for white 27-year-olds. When you isolate Black 27-year-olds, 66% of Black 27-year-olds grew up in an impoverished neighborhood. So how can that be maintained in a nation that says that it prioritizes equality? I think we would argue that we're apathetic towards that reality.
When you teach these things in your classroom, do you get a backlash from parents or from your students?
Students are so eager for these conversations, and that's true regardless of their political background. So it's not like this is dividing in the classroom along political lines where liberals want to talk, but conservatives don't. No, kids want to have the conversation. They're eager for knowledge. They want to understand why our city looks the way it does. What I would say specific to my classroom, I don't get a lot of pushback from parents, but that's because there is a face to the conversation. There is much more pushback at sort of like the general system, this fear. People think teachers sort of come from this shadowy area and they're here to indoctrinate children. But with individual teachers, they're not as likely to make that accusation.
Gloria, when you hear Matt talk about his experience and that split between, hey, I know my kid's teacher, and, well, wait a minute, what's this system doing to my kid? How common would you say that experience is?
I think Matt is right. Is spot on in what he's sharing with us. And I wish more teachers would be willing to do the things that he's doing. When I can have the students at the university level, what I find is a tremendous amount of anger because no one taught them these very things. They say, hey, I'm smart. I'm in the top 10% of my class. Why didn't I know that? Why didn't I know Wisconsin had sundown towns? Why didn't I know that Wisconsin is considered the worst place to raise a Black child? Why, how can these patterns of behavior or patterns of outcomes and results exist without a deeper, more systemic explanation? So I don't think that our young people resist wanting to know this. They want an explanation. And unfortunately, what we have, and I'm not even saying parents so much as it is, organized opposition that then riles up parents to tell them, this is a very bad thing. You don't want your kids to know this. But it's very hard to look at what happened. We all had to literally watch the 8 minutes and 46 seconds or 9 minutes and 26 seconds, as we later learned in the trial, of a man die. And parents had to respond to kids and say, why is this happening?
Matt, when kids come to you and you teach high school, is this the first time that they are reckoning with these concepts? Or is it something that they've encountered earlier in their education?
It's not the first
time. And I should say, I guess, white kids, because obviously kids of color have already dealt with this.
I mean, what I would say is that students tend to have had shallow level conversations. And they tend to think that they understand some issues. And then they come to class and are shocked at the level that this is sort of seeped into the fabric of society. What I tell my students, though, there's this great fear in the community that we are teaching white kids to hate themselves. what I tell them is like, oh my God, if you walk out of this class and you feel guilt, you've missed the point. You know, I tell them like, this is the house we live in, but it's not the house we built. We don't have guilt for the past. We do have responsibility for the future. And that's what we're trying to teach. But there is this incredible fear that we are actually engaging in this process of, to be honest, there are shades of replacement theory, this idea that we are trying to sort of replace whiteness in America. There's fears that we're trying to teach white kids to hate themselves so that they don't join the conversation and just sort of let power shift. And there's fear that this entire thing is just sort of like this Marxist Trojan horse that is going to take over the public schools from the inside.
Gloria, how should schools and districts respond to that kind of fear that, oh, you're out there indoctrinating our kids, when white parents freak out about that?
Well, I would tell you that public schools have an obligation to promote a set of, quote, American values. And that to me is the wonderful aspect of this work, is because if we go back to American values, we talk about equality, we talk about justice, and we can just fundamentally ask the question, is it just for us to have a criminal justice system that only allows those who have enough money to come out on, say, bail? Is it just that we are suspending kids who are Black and brown at a rate 4 to 5 more times greater than we would do for kids who are white? So to ask the fundamental question of justice and equality, and for schools to say, we are going to stand for these democratic values, I wouldn't waver from that. There is nothing democratic about racism.
Matt, I asked you about the experience of your white kids, but I'm curious, for the Black and brown and Indigenous kids you teach, what has their experience been like when you are having these conversations?
The conversations I've had have given me the sense that my non-white students feel like the process of going through public school in a majority white city, it's like having to hold your breath through years and years and years, and you're just desperate to sort of get to the surface to get some air. And so kids tend to be relieved that we are finally having honest conversations about race, where we are describing it in the way it operates, and that we're not denying its existence and we're not denying their lived experiences. And so that's sort of been the sense that I get, is that once they trust me, it's like this, finally they hit the surface and there's this breath of fresh air, finally.
Matt, I want to talk about George Floyd's murder and Derek Chauvin's trial. It certainly changed the way a lot of white people think and talk about race. Did you change your curriculum?
I would say that I geared my curriculum towards this specific situation. So we were already talking about segregation, redlining, the way that sort of folks have access or don't have access to different opportunities, and the way that that leads to disparate outcomes. I was not talking so specifically about policing itself. Before the murder of George Floyd, I didn't have such a particular focus on policing. Since then, for example, a project that I just worked on, I conducted a series of interviews with all sorts of different people, the police chief. I talked to folks who were formerly incarcerated for decades. I talked to people doing prison reform, civil rights work. And we sort of conducted these interviews to sort of display all these different voices in the conversation, trying to help kids work towards empathy and understanding of this sort of this broader system at work.
You know, Gloria, Matt sounds like a pretty extraordinary teacher who kids are lucky to talk to. I wonder if you could speak a little more broadly about how teachers and school districts are generally attempting to modify their curriculum to deal with conversations around George Floyd's murder, around Black Lives Matter, and national conversations about race.
Well, I will tell you that Matt is indeed an exceptional teacher. He actually reminds me of another Matt, who is a former student of mine who teaches in North Carolina, who does some very similar things that he is doing. In general, I think teachers want to stay at arm's length with this topic. The parallel for me is whenever you start talking about sex education, right? Let's not talk about it. Schools shouldn't bring it up. and we act as if not talking about it means kids won't do it. Well, I think it's the same thing around race. Not talking about it means it's just going to go away. It is not going away. And I think we owe it to our young people to tell them the truth, to help them, give them the tools so they can research themselves and begin to discover some of the things that have put us in this particular position. I don't know that most students are having the experience that kids like Matt's students or like the students that I get to talk to in Carrboro, North Carolina. I think in general, we talk about it as something that used to be. So we put it in the context of slavery and the Civil War, and then we move on. And if you just look at the textbooks that our kids have access to, the essential narrative is we used to do that, but now we're better.
I'm wondering about that, actually, because textbooks obviously are a big thing here, and the sort of materials that school districts have. If you're a parent, Gloria, and you're listening to this, or your kid comes home with something and you think, that doesn't really match the experience of the country I live in, what can you do?
Well, I think that, you know, parents who are tuned into what's happening in schools and classrooms are willing to have a conversation. You know, Matt talked about the fact that his students, as well as his parents, trust him. And I've had that same experience as a parent and even as a grandparent, that I've had the opportunity to go to school and see for myself, not just assume that because it's in the textbook, that the teacher's not having kids interrogated, that the teacher's not having kids question it. I just had a conversation with a parent in Houston, and his daughter came home and said, "Dad, I don't understand this concept that we have in this book about the first Texans." They were actually referring to indigenous people. I cannot imagine an American Indian calling themselves, "Oh, we're the first Texans." No, we're the original people who lived here. So it's those kinds of things that textbooks promote because they have to get through committees to be able to be sold, that don't tell our kids authentic histories.
This is obviously a big talking point in conservative media. Matt, is that something that you've come up against either with parents or administrators or even other colleagues?
I mean, I would say that our administration has largely tried to be supportive of us as we navigate what is honestly a minefield. I can tell you that our community, the backlash in our community is growing. Unfortunately, a lot of the backlash is based off of untruths, even I would argue propaganda. So there's a series of things that thousands of parents in our district believe is happening that is not happening. And so the slogan of this counter movement has become anti-racism is racism. And I see posts every single day in these growing parent groups. They're building connections with one another. They're getting ready to endorse school board candidates and potentially run their own candidates. They're sending news to national conservative media. They've been on state radio. They're filming teachers because, you know, we teach on Zoom and in person at the same time. And so they are watching and in some circumstances filming their kids' teachers. They're fighting for legislation to ban critical race theory, although their definition of that is so broad that it would essentially exclude conversations about race. They want to ban the 1619 Project.
Based on the New York Times, the New York Times Magazine project. Yeah,
that's correct. Right. And so it's a minefield because you have to find a way to be honest, to uphold the human dignity of every one of your students. We can't compromise on that, but also try to find some way to bring the community along and be like, listen, we're not indoctrinating your kids. We're trying to have a discussion.
Gloria, how would you respond to conservative critics who don't believe that race should play a role in the curriculum? And again, I want to underline white critics generally, because I think that, you know, for kids of color, race is there from day one.
Right. And you have the misfortune of having two social studies people on this conversation. as I'm listening to Matt talking about the organized opposition, one of the things that it reminds me of, you know, historians are going to be historians. And so I certainly take a historical look at this. It's like the Red Scare, that there's a communist everywhere. And so we got to watch everybody. We are literally performing that same kind of behavior with teachers and school districts around race. We are saying something's there that's not there. We're frightening people about whatever this is. And I think just trying to understand inequality is something that we owe our students. They need to begin, you know, we didn't murder George Floyd individually, but we witnessed it, and we witnessed it at a time in which we are all sort of hunkered down in our homes because of the pandemic. And so parents and community members had to provide an explanation because the students demanded it. Schools are perfectly set up to begin to uncover these issues, to begin to explore them. And why would we want our students to be ignorant? What I say to people when they say, well, that doesn't exist, there's no systemic racism, give me an explanation for the regular and predictable inequality that exists in health, in education, in employment, in housing, in criminal justice. Just get, what's the explanation? Now, some people will say, oh, well, it's class. Okay. Well, I can then disaggregate something like housing and banking and begin to show you that a working class white person is much more likely to get a loan than a middle class Black person. We need people to be able to have intelligent conversations about inequality in our society.
Gloria Ladson-Billings, Professor Emerita at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and former Kellner Family Chair in Urban Education, and Matt Bockenfeld, a social studies teacher at Fishers High School in Fishers, Indiana. Thank you both so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thanks so much.
We've been discussing schools and the teaching of systemic racism, both past and present. And we wanted to hear from you. So we asked, were you taught about systemic racism in school? And if you have kids, how is racial equity in history being addressed in their education? Here's what you told us.
Hi, this is Julie in Orlando, Florida. And I was not taught about systemic racism in school because I went to school in the 70s. But my mom was wonderful, and she taught me to always be friends with anybody you liked, regardless of their skin color. I don't recall her saying the word racism to describe what she was trying to tell me about.
Hi, my name is Julie Bailey, New York, New York. And I believe the question was vis-a-vis being taught about systemic racism in school. And quite frankly, my answer is I was taught nothing. I am of a certain age, but I know I was taught nothing. I had to live it. I'm a Black child of immigrants growing up in America, and we learn about systemic racism through the school of hard knocks. Trust me, it's a school you never graduate from.
Hi, my name's Margaret, and I'm calling from Seattle. I didn't learn anything about racism in my very segregated schools in Scottsdale, Arizona in the 70s, which was ironic since it was less than a mile from the edge of the Pima Reservation and on land that used to be in part of Mexico. We barely learned about anti-Semitism. We only learned about the Holocaust because a parent of a student came in and taught us that. It wasn't in the curriculum. My daughter went to an integrated school here in Seattle and learned a bit more about racism, but I would say that the learning that she got was very individualized and without nuance. And I believe that we need to talk about institutional racism all throughout our curriculum in histories, social studies, the arts, and literature.
This is Barbara calling from Denton. So I was homeschooled by white, deeply religious parents that had four bio kids and adopted three from Ethiopia and Burkina Faso. And on the one hand, my dad was great about educating us on the reason for the Civil War and the civil rights movement. But on the other hand, racism was treated as a problem of the past and systemic racism was not recognized. My parents believed that because they adopted black children, they basically can't possibly be racist. And they'll even say, we adopted black kids, we did our part, as if you could live in a state of arrival. Ironically, my mother has a habit of speaking about my adopted siblings with frustration that they're not like the bio kids, as in they don't act very white. So yeah.
The education I got about systemic racism while I was in grammar school was so immersive and subconscious that I didn't realize it until high school with my non-white classmates who challenged my perspective on everything. I'm John Clark from Wantagh, New York.
My name is Mercedes. I'm in Morristown, New Jersey. But I grew up outside the U.S. and was amazed when my kids started high school in the U.S. that all the U.S. history taught made minimal reference to how black people's contributions impacted the country favorably and seemed to minimize the crippling effects of slavery and Jim Crow.
Thanks, as always, for being part of the conversation. We love to hear from you. The number to call is 877-869-8253. That's 877-8-MY-TAKE if you still have letters on your phone pads. Or you can send us a voice memo to takeawaycallers@gmail.com.
This week's On the Media, one former NPR editor's grievances are reverberating far beyond a Substack essay. He claims wokeness is ruining the place.
That marginalized people are storming the barricades and dictating that this story happens and this story gets killed and we're going to use this language and not use that language. That's not what I saw.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
As more and more people get vaccinated against COVID-19, we're also learning of other illnesses they did not catch due to the COVID-19 pandemic. A new report from ProPublica has documented a rising number of people diagnosed with cancer, particularly more advanced stages of cancer. And it's not that more people are getting cancer. It's just that the COVID-19 pandemic prevented many people from being diagnosed earlier. It's an effect that's been felt by lots of different people, but it's particularly acute in communities of color, and the lack of preventative care may have repercussions for years to come. Joining me now is Dua El-Deeb, an investigative reporter for ProPublica who wrote the story. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So can you break down for us sort of what happened with preventative cancer screenings and treatments last year when the pandemic started?
Sure. So this story is really about what happened when we weren't looking, when we were all focused on COVID. So immediately after the pandemic hit, preventative cancer screenings dropped by as much as 94% across the country. So chemo and radiation were suspended or delayed. And in addition to people not getting their mammograms or colonoscopies, people also weren't going to the doctor. So if they were feeling symptoms, normally they would schedule an appointment with their primary care doctor or go to the clinic. That also wasn't happening. So all of that combined led to this drop in diagnoses, in some cases by more than 50%. And wow, that was kind of the backdrop to what we're seeing now.
Yeah, it sounds like it's an issue both of people not doing regular screening, but then you also had these delays in procedures that were sort of pushed off, especially during the early days of the pandemic. Did you learn anything about kind of the consequences of those delays?
Yeah, so at the beginning, you know, remember the messaging was don't come into the hospital, you know, unless you're very, very sick. Let's conserve resources, save them for the people with COVID. And even after that messaging shifted a bit, people were still afraid to go in. And so now looking at the aftermath, what we see are people have now started to return to the hospital and to their doctors, but they're coming in with more advanced cancers. And typically the way that it works with cancer is, you know, the earlier the diagnosis, the sooner treatment starts, the better the outcomes. But now, unfortunately, the effects are going to be long-lasting. So the National Cancer Institute has predicted almost 10,000 excess deaths over the next decade from breast and colorectal cancer alone because of pandemic-related delays in diagnosis and treating those cancers.
And breast cancer is one of those particular kinds of cancers where if caught early, you know, a lot can be done. I was struck by something in your story that highlighted the disproportionate burden of breast cancer, particularly later stage breast cancer, on Latina women.
Yes, and that's what's so frustrating about this story. During the pandemic, what we saw was that the pandemic exacerbated a lot of, you know, structural racism that had been built into our healthcare system. And so, you know, people of color, communities of color were hit hardest. And, you know, before the pandemic, Black Americans were already dying of all cancers combined at a higher rate than any other racial group. Latino Americans, you know, cancer was the leading cause of death for Latinos. And like you said, breast cancer specifically for women. And now, looking at the impact of the pandemic on cancer care, those same communities are expected to be hit particularly hard.
Dua, you wrote about this woman, Teresa Rubalcaba, in your story, and her story just floored me. Tell me a little bit about her.
So Teresa is a 48-year-old factory worker and mother who spent almost half her life working at the same Chicago candy factory. She loves her three children. She loves her job. And that's why when the pandemic hit, and many of us were able to work from home, she kept working at the factory. She was afraid of losing her job. She was afraid of falling again behind on her mortgage, not being able to provide for her family. And she was also afraid of going to the doctor or the ER in the middle of a pandemic. So she ignored her symptoms. You know, she was saying that her right breast was swelling and she was so embarrassed that somebody at the work might notice. So she started stuffing her left side of her bra so no one would notice. Mm-hmm. And she grew more tired and her breast was growing more and more inflamed, but she kept going into work until one day it just got to be too much. And so she said, okay, I'm going to take time off of work. I'm going to schedule a telehealth visit and then I'll, you know, be back at work the next day. And she did that visit. But the doctor couldn't examine her in person. She examined her through a computer screen and she told her, oh, it looks like an infection. Here are some antibiotics. And of course, it wasn't an infection. The antibiotics didn't work. And so she ended up at the emergency room of Mount Sinai Hospital in Chicago, where she met the oncologist, Dr. Khosla, and she was later diagnosed with stage 4 inflammatory breast cancer.
You have a description in your story of Dr. Khosla examining Teresa and that her breast felt like the skin of an orange, that it was something that Dr. Khosla doesn't even see that often because usually things don't get that far.
Right. And inflammatory breast cancer in general is a rare type of breast cancer. And for it to get to this point was something that Dr. Khosla, she said she hadn't seen it this severe in about a decade.
Mm. What do you think Teresa's story tells us about the sort of life of essential workers and also workers of color during this pandemic?
I think it just shows this huge gap in who is able to access care and who is able to get the care that they need and who can't. She started feeling symptoms last year. She was actively kind of hiding her symptoms, ignoring them for more than 6 months because she was afraid, because she had to keep working. And that to me is just speaks volumes as to what's wrong with the way things are happening right now in our society.
What has that 6 months cost her?
Unfortunately, at this point, her cancer has metastasized. So it's gone, spread beyond her breast to her hip and to her bones and to her lymph nodes. What Dr. Khosla told me is that if she would have come in 6 months earlier, she likely would have undergone chemo and surgery and been done. But now she's incurable.
It's not just the sort of Teresas of the country who are being harmed by this right now. But when we think about the preventative screenings or the long-lasting effects that the pandemic could have on care or even on research, what have you learned?
Unfortunately, this is going to result in a devastating toll, loss of life, and just the ripple effects that it will have on families. You know, the story also looks a lot at Teresa's son, Sergio, who...
An aspiring doctor,
yes, who graduated college and had, was pre-med, had all these plans to go to medical school, but he put his life on hold to come back and help with the bills. And then the pandemic hit. And so, he said, I'll wait a little bit longer. And then his mom got sick. And now he doesn't know when he'll be able to start back up that process of becoming a doctor and going to medical school. So unfortunately, it's so far reaching. And in terms of, research and cancer progress, we had made so much progress in this country when it came to reducing cancer mortality. There had been a drop of 31% in cancer death rates from 1991 to 2018. And now the fear is all of that is going to be pushed back because the focus shifted. I mean, I talked to oncologists who said that they had their grants that that were in the pipeline for cancer research, get canceled because that money was shifting to COVID research.
So it's not just a question of care, but also that the singular focus on COVID has sort of crowded out the funding for thinking about how we treat cancer in the future.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, what we know about cancer is that, this is a field that with research, we're constantly learning more. We're constantly coming up with new drugs and new treatment options. So that's another a lingering effect that's going to cost us in the long run.
I am someone who frankly has put off my own mammogram during this, and I think it's understandable that people might be nervous about going to the doctor, going to a hospital. If someone is listening to this and thinking, I probably do need to make this appointment, what should they know and what do experts say about, the risks of COVID versus the risks of going undiagnosed?
I'll tell you what I heard from every single oncologist and public health expert that I spoke to for this story, which is don't delay care. During the very beginning of the pandemic, nobody knew, what this was. This was a new virus. Nobody knew, how it was really being transmitted, what the risks were. But now people understand, and hospitals and doctors' offices have taken safety precautions to really protect people from COVID. And as one oncologist put it to me, it's much safer now to go into a doctor's office than it is to have cancer unknowingly growing inside of you.
Dua El-Deeb, an investigative reporter for ProPublica, wrote this incredible story. Dua, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
The category is... Live. Work.
This past Sunday, the FX show Pose kicked off its third and final season. Since its debut, the groundbreaking television series has chronicled New York City's ball scene of the 80s and 90s. Ball culture is a mix of performance, dance, modeling, and competition, mainly consisting of LGBTQ people who've been outcast to the fringes of society because of their sexuality. ball and house culture are filled with young people who've been forced to find family in a non-biological context.
We fought for our place at this table, and that has made us stronger than you will ever be. Now pick your jaw off the floor and go back to your clam chowder and shallow conversations. My girlfriends and I aren't going anywhere.
Pose is far from the first TV show or movie to look at ball culture, from Marlon Riggs' Tongues Untied to Jenny Livingston's Paris is Burning to RuPaul's Drag Race. Hollywood has long taken an interest in the underground LGBTQ and ballroom competitions of past and present. But Pose has introduced a new generation to ball culture.
Didn't you hear the news? I'm walking with the House of Evangelista to help them win a trophy or 10, but mostly to destroy you.
For more on this, we're joined by Elegance Bratton, director, writer, producer, and creator of My House on Viceland and the documentary Pure Kids. Elegance, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
For people who haven't seen Pose or your work, can you explain a little bit about how ball culture came to be?
Ball culture starts with the kind of Faustian scenario of American culture, right? Black life and white life. By virtue of being Black, you are living in the antithesis of the American dream. Because of systemic oppression and systemic racism, and you are now forced to find a place to have your value. That's just kind of ground zero for being Black in America. Now, when you throw in the queer element, you get into ballroom culture. In my estimation, ballroom begins on the plantation with the kind of playtime of enslaved African Americans who are imitating their oppressors, their captors. And in so doing, there creates a little liminal space for queer performance that then transforms once we get into freedom in the 1920s. You know, Blacks are leaving the South in droves, heading up north where we go to Harlem and the masquerade ball system where you have a gender performance kind of component of that. And then you kind of have the reality of being Black where you're hyper-incarcerated, you're hyper-surveilled by police. And voguing gets its start in Rikers Island, right? Where you have separate units for LGBT or gay and transgender individuals. And in those units, instead of getting into kind of knockdown, drag out fights, these folks were like posing and again, imitating white high society for laughs and status amongst themselves. So in my mind, ballroom begins in the scenario of slavery, continues through the Great Migration and lands within the kind of the response to Black freedom, which is hyper-incarceration in the prison industrial complex at Rikers Island.
Why do you think a show like Pose or your work has found such an enthusiastic audience today?
I think we live at a time when people are generally skeptical of mainstream institutions. We've been let down by the electoral process in the Trump administration. We've been set by just totally astonished as the Supreme Court just shifts and takes shape, sometimes against over half of the country's, you know, progressive and socialist leanings. And we are all interested in finding alternatives to systems that have failed us. And I think one of the, I guess, silver linings of racism in America is that by virtue of being excluded, Blacks have an advantage in creating entertaining culture because it's a means of survival for us. If we can't be president, if we can't go to Congress, if we can't vote, right, we can entertain. And that's a way where we can get money. And more importantly, we can't be employed because of our race as well. Like we're less likely to have the same opportunities as a white person. So entertainment culture just becomes a natural space to claim political power. And as a result, Black queer entertainment culture is just fascinating. People, I think a lot of women are finding their voice through Black gay culture, and a lot of, you know, conversations between Black men, heterosexual men and heterosexual women in terms of how we relate to one another, right? And the toxicity of masculinity is interrogated by a show like Pose. And I think that's why at this particular moment, work about this culture is really starting to, you know, bubble up and lead the mainstream conversation.
Houses and a sense of belonging to a house is a big part of ball culture. What roles do a house play?
Houses play both a tangible role in that, you know, these are networks of individuals who can depend on one another for life-sustaining resources, right? Like, I've seen house mothers feed, you know, 5-10 homeless kids out of their purses. I've seen house mothers buy the same kids effects for their ball, you know, so in that regard, and I've also seen these mothers literally house the children. So in that regard, it's, you know, key material, life-sustaining resources. And on the other side, there's something a bit more ephemeral, right? A house provides a kind of ruling ideology around this alternative social network so that not only does it happen, but it happens in an organized structure where you have a mother, a father, brother, sister, the prince and princess, you know, so many different titles within the house, all geared around engaging, in my mind, engaging the LGBT homeless youth of color to make up for what they're lacking because they've been ostracized by the heterosexual mainstream society.
What do you think the impact of seeing, in some cases, the actors on this show, LGBTQ actors of color? I'm thinking of Billy Porter out on red carpets pre-pandemic. What impact does seeing them working and working at this lauded level have?
It impacts in every meaningful way in that we have representation for people who look like Billy and look like MJ and look like Dominique, right? They get to see and imagine themselves, the possibility of themselves in places like the Met Gala and, you know, on the red carpet of the Golden Globes. And then for this industry, it proves that individuals like Billy Porter and Dominique Ross, MJ Rodriguez, India Moore, that these are models of success and that we need to find more of them. Because, you know, once something hits, the way it works is the whole industry is trying to create the next version of it for the next generation. So hopefully we'll see many more icons of trans, Black, queer experience.
In the earlier season, some of the characters on Pose are involved in sex work. And I wonder how significant you thought it was to see something like that on a network TV show.
No, I go back and forth on that one because most times you see trans people on network television, it's as a sex worker. Yeah. So in that regard, I think that this, like, you know, the way that shows sell is that, you know, there has to be something that's kind of relevant to what's been done before and then a little twist to it that makes it modern, right? So I think in the case of Pose, the twist is we get to see the life of the trans of color, you know, Black and Latinx sex worker from their eyes and from the community that depends on them for this work's eyes, right? And I think that's really, really important that now instead of looking at them through the lens of the kind of stereotypical white gaze, which views anybody who's a gender rebel as some sort of, you know, deviant slash pariah, we get to see these same individuals on a show like Pose as heroes, as, you know, freedom fighters in a way, right? These are, you know, Harriet Tubman gets, and rightfully so, you know, she is lauded as being someone that has, you know, walked Black people out of bondage and into freedom, you know, at a time when it was, you know, very, very difficult for her to do. These Black trans women of the ballroom, you know, the Dorian Corey of Paris is Burning, the characters on Pose, the characters in My House and Peer Kids, Crystal LaBeija, you know, these women are doing much of the same work in the legacy of Harriet Tubman. They are leading Black youth who, without them, would have zero, not even a little piece of rock to hold on to in their climb up the up the class ladder. So I think Pose and looking at these sex workers through the eyes of queer Black liberation, right? This is monumental. This is the twist that we've needed to use this medium as a way to build empathy and cross-cultural understanding.
I feel like Pose and ball culture are both extremely celebratory, but then when you think about this season, we're talking about 1994 and the AIDS epidemic. How does the show capture, do you think, what that experience was like?
I think the show, this is a tough one for me, again, right? Because as much as I love and appreciate Pose and am inspired by the creators of Pose, many of them are my friends. Many of them are my friends. They are, you know, I view them of great esteem. That being said, I think that Pose, there's just a lot of weight when you are the pioneer of something. And a huge part of being a pioneer in this culture is the kind of the, I call it the educational tax. And when we talk about a show humanizing people or kind of teaching the masses, right? What we're talking about inherently is the white gaze, right? Who doesn't believe that Black people are not human? Who's erected an entire, you know, culture and civilization around the premise that trans people don't even rightfully exist, right? So we are privileging, so to a certain extent, I think Pose's depiction of the early 90s is very much empathetic to like a white male gaze and a white gaze that does not want to hold the feet to the fire, right? Like, you know, I mean, first of all, you don't see any queer Black revolutionaries of that era on Pose. There's no SS Info. There's no Marlon Riggs. There's no Joseph Beam. These are individuals who went to balls in the 80s and 90s, who were infected with HIV, who were a part of the ACT UP movement, right? And particularly when we talk about something like ACT UP, you know, which occurs like in 1987, right?
Yeah.
Which is like kind of lauded as this radical queer pink power kind of response to AIDS, right?
Lauded today, but was so controversial at the time.
Right, right. And you have, I mean, and literally you have these white people climbing government structures. Do you know what I mean? Black people could never do that. Black people could never have that type of, just even right now with the murder of George Floyd, and we kind of hear this kind of mainstream media conversation about quote unquote rioting, right? These people who stormed the doors, it was always looked at as a political response because these men were white. That landed with Black people in the movement. There were plenty of Black and Latino people in the ACT UP movement with the white people downtown. You know, and if you watch Pose, it kind of feels like it almost all happens in Harlem or the Bronx. And in reality, people from Harlem and the Bronx went downtown and sought help and were sidelined by these white people. Right. Like, and here we are today. One out of two Black gay men are projected to have HIV in their lifetime. 70% of the people who are homeless and young in this country are Black youth. We can't. So do I think the show is, I think the show is very much bringing life to this history in a nuanced and absolutely essential way. However, I wonder if it's a little too soft. Like when I think about Ryan Murphy's canon, you know, like when you think about a show like Hollywood and all of the characters of fascination that show up in that show who actually existed, characters that never existed. You look at, you know, a show like American Horror Story that is so kind of, you know, almost willy-nilly with the timeline, if you will. I wonder why aren't these, like, for instance, have you ever heard of a thing called GMAD, Gay Men of African Descent?
Yeah.
GMAD was started by a Black gay man by the name of Charles Angel, who was a very active member of ACT UP. He got sick of being sidelined by ACT UP and then went to Brooklyn and started his own organization to deal with HIV and AIDS in the Black community specifically, because he felt ACT UP was not doing what it needed to do. Now, I think Pose lives in a reality where ACT UP has never done what it's supposed to do. So to a certain extent, right, it's affirming in that it imagines a world where, you know, Blacks were doing it for themselves. However, I think kind of skipping over that particular beat of the history, I don't know. I think, again, this is the problem. This is the great problem of being a pioneer, is that all of the work gets put on your shoulders. What I'm grateful for in my career right now and the work that I have coming out, I know that Pose has made a positive impact on my possibilities as a Black storyteller in this medium, and it has taken some of the burden off of me to have to explain and humanize my experience for a white gaze because it's already done that. However, if we're going to really stand on, if I'm to stand on the shoulders of these giants and make my mark inspired by them, then I feel it's necessary to really talk about what is on screen and what actually happened, and to kind of look at, you know, the Ryan Murphy machine. And the question I have is, why isn't Essex Hemphill on the show? Why isn't Marlon Riggs was shooting Ballroom before Jenny Livingston shot Ballroom and Paris is Burning? Why isn't a character like that on the show? Right. But when we go to Hollywood, you know, we can have Rock Hudson, we can, everybody can be on the show. You know what I'm saying? Everybody is able to be in.
Yeah.
And I just don't understand it. And it's a part of what inspires me to do what I do, so that I can kind of contribute, you know, my perspective on it. You know, I was making My House before Pose was out. My show premiered a week before Pose, you know, and I get it, you know, there's no hard feelings, but at the same time, we have to interrogate all of America's economic systems. I think, you know, even Janet recently kind of said some things about this where, you know, she pulled back the curtain generously and showed us some of what was going on behind the scenes. And she spoke to how the injustice.
Janet Mock.
And I think, you know, the injustice of this is that, you know, when white people show up to black spaces where we have been the whole time filming ourselves, you know, listening to ourselves, talking about ourselves, and they get this huge groundswell of support for doing what we already do, there in which you have a scenario where black lives matter less than white lives. And I think going forward, you know, Hollywood has to be much more exacting in its mission to diversify and include. And also, you know, look at this, you know, why is it that when, you know, white people do black things, it's suddenly news, but when black people do it, somehow it's less worthy.
Elegant Spratton is the creator of My House, which is on Viceland, and the documentary Peer Kids. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us.
Thank you so much for having me. And I wish all of your audience safety and health going forward.
All right, that is it for us today. Glad you're making it through the week with us. And just a note that tomorrow we'll be covering the Facebook Oversight Board ruling that came down today on former President Trump's account. The Independent Oversight Board has upheld his suspension from the platform for now, but said Facebook needs to complete a review on its broader policies, including what they mean for Trump, in the next 6 months. We want to hear your thoughts on this because we're talking about it on the next show. So here's how you do it. You have three options. Number one, call us at 877-869-8253. That's 877-8-MY-TAKE. Number two, record a voice memo on your phone and email it to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. We love that one because it sounds like you're in the room with us. Number three, you can click on Contact Us at thetakeaway.org and record a message there. Whatever your preference, just talk with us. That's up on the next Takeaway. All right, thank you so much for being with us. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.